and be very welcome here at the House of Europe, here at The Hague. The Hague House of Europe, the official premises of the European Union here in the Netherlands. And welcome here the students from University of Leiden and Montesquieu, the people from Montesquieu, and Mr. Mugger, very welcome here at the official representation of the European Union on behalf of the European Parliament. My name is Sjaap van der Vaart, and I'm representing the European Parliament, European democracy here in the Netherlands, together with my colleague Jimmy Jamar. He is the head of the representation of the European Commission, both here in the House of Europe. The House of Europe now officially opened as of May the 16th by Her Majesty the Queen, with Mr. Barroso and Vice President of the European Parliament, Mr. Lambrinidis. And now it is open, and you have the honor here to be one of our many guests. It's also your House of Europe. And since we're open for all inhabitants of the European Union. And as of May the 16th, this House is a vibrant piece and place of debate and democracy here. We have had many groups and many NGOs and civil society organizations debating European integration. And now we face a crisis, I might say an existential crisis, and that's not altogether a bad thing. Europe is good in crisis. That means a crisis, I mean, the English verb is a proverb, I might say, is never waste a good crisis, and that's what I hope the European political elite will do. So be aware of the most interesting and particular point in time that we're in, because tomorrow the European Council starts in Brussels, which is the council of all councils, or the mother of all councils, to paraphrase the war in Iraq. So we're facing now the key question, what are we going to do facing the reality of this financial and economical crisis? And this is a thing which is related to the question of the democratic legitimation of European integration policies. And one might say that it is the average citizen that is now at the short end of this integration process and of the end in the whole frame of the crisis itself. I mean, to what extent are citizens in the European Union represented in this process of crisis policies? To what extent can national parliaments debate about the solutions that are being reached by a very small elite of European government leaders, notably only two, right? So, I mean, even our own Prime Minister, Mr. Rutte, is with his colleagues looking at the rear side of the big car, of the big Mercedes, in which Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Sarkozy are sitting. So all other government leaders are also at the short end of this process. So not only European democracies and in national parliaments, but also European democracy itself is at the short end of the crisis now, because the European Parliament, of which we are the representation here in the Netherlands, has a very, very small role to play. And if you look back to the beginning of the whole thing, you could see that the choice has been made for an intergovernmental pitch and not for the community method, which means that European Parliament has only played a very small role once it comes to checks and balances on the power of the European Council, notably the two leaders at stake, Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Sarkozy. So there are all kinds of democratic deficits here up in the air, and maybe this could be one of the subjects to talk about this afternoon on the question of a new democratic legitimation for this process of European integration, not only integration, but also on the question whether there will be a new narrative. Somewhere along the way, to quote William Wallace, we have lost that narrative. And the question is, if the answer of this crisis will be more Europe, which is more political integration, does the European political elite, in that respect, have a narrative for their own citizens, for their own electorates? Well, that question, these questions, this vital question, has not been answered. And this is a very interesting panorama to watch the coming next weeks. So we are privileged onlookers, and maybe this could be a start. Arco, for you the floor on behalf of the Montesquieu Institute.
Thanks a lot, Sherp. And thanks very much for hosting us in this beautifully renovated building, the House of Europe for the Dutch people. You mentioned the mother of all European councils, which is being held in the next 2 days. And one of the questions, as you say, is whether actually the mother of all these council meetings is still living up to how the founding fathers of the European Union envisioned European integration. And at the heart of these questions are questions about democracy. How much do we like to sustain democracy in our member states, and how much do we want to level up to the European institutions? And I'm very happy to announce our keynote speaker of today, Dr. Daniel Mugge from the University of Amsterdam, lecturer in political economy. And he wrote an awarded book on European financial markets and governance, or perhaps the lack of governance, state steering, that won the Jean Blondel Prize for the best PhD in the European Consortium for Political Research in 2009. And Daniel is going to share with us his views on not only on financial issues in the European community, European Union, but also the questions whether we are walking towards solutions that actually work from a democratic perspective, both about process, how many involvement of citizens of member states is there and how much is required to give more legitimacy, and also from a substantive point of view, looking at the nature of the financial crisis as we experience it since 2008. So happy to announce you, Daniel. The floor is yours for some 45 minutes. And then I would like to involve you all in a discussion with Daniel about the issues that we have on the agenda today. Okay.
Thank you very much, Arco. Thank you as well. Thanks to our hosts here in the House of Europe, and of course, thanks to all of you for coming here today. As has been mentioned, the summit begins tomorrow, and many people in Europe have the feeling that the European drama that has been unfolding over the past years may be about to reach its climax. We're surrounded by breathless journalists, we're surrounded by clueless observers, by sleepless policymakers. And I think it's fair to say that if we follow media reporting these days, then short-term thinking rules. We're always thinking until the next morning the markets open, what's going to happen to Italian bond spread, Spanish government debt. So I think before we plunge into these 72 hours of drama, this is a good moment to pause for some reflection. Let's take this moment of the quiet before the storm to take a step back and to ask ourselves, what is really at stake here in this crisis? And more importantly, if we're thinking about the different scenarios, the different outcomes that this crisis may have, what would really be a good yardstick for a solution that comes out of it? As we put the different proposals that are on the table next to each other, how should we evaluate them? What is a desirable outcome of the crisis? To my mind, this yardstick for an evaluation of any sensible solution to this crisis has actually two important components. When I cycle to my work in the morning at the University of Amsterdam, I pass a fairly new monument just next to the municipal building of Amsterdam. There is a monument of Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza, the philosopher. Very nice monument. And at the bottom is engraved one of the more well-known quotes from Spinoza. The goal of the state is freedom. The goal of the state is freedom. Now, that is a statement that is, good Amsterdam tradition, open to a wide variety of interpretations. But when I hear the goal of the state is freedom, then I interpret it in a way that is in many ways inspired by Amartya Sen. Namely, that freedom means putting people in control of their own lives and their own destiny. That is freedom. And what that then means is that the goal of the state is to help people to become individually and collectively more in control of their lives and their own fates. The realization that is in this quote is that collectively, acting together, we have something to win when we think about this kind of freedom. It's not only about individual freedom, it's about a collective freedom. So I say the first yardstick is, I want an order to emerge from this crisis that puts more than is the case now, the European people in charge of their own life. The second yardstick is something that you could call sustainability. Now, most people, when they hear sustainability, they think of ecological sustainability. They think of climate change. They think of recyclable plastic bottles, these sorts of things. And that's not at all what I mean. Sustainability means that acquiring, enjoying something today does not undermine your ability to acquire or enjoy the same thing tomorrow. It means that realizing prosperity, welfare today is not dependent on something that, by the same token, undermines that same welfare tomorrow. So if you put these two together, you could say the yardstick is, I want a European order to emerge from this crisis that puts people in charge, that also puts their children in charge, or it doesn't undermine the capacity of Europe's children, a generation hence, to be in charge of their own fate as much as will be the case today. So put these together and you say you want a social and political order to emerge from this, in which the European people have a stake, there's something in it for them, and they have a voice as well. I'm sure you hear me talking and think, well, it's all nice and fine, but what on earth does that have to do with the Europe? Well, mind you, there is a very direct link. Because if the way that financial markets have evolved over these past years has taught us something, then it is that while financial markets have the capacity to equip us with welfare, put us in charge of our own lives, can also be an enormously constraining force. We've seen people protesting in the streets of Athens, of Rome, of Madrid, of Lisbon. Maybe 2 years from now we'll see them here on the Mali and the Hague. Financial crisis has constrained individuals in many ways. Securities have been taken away. People have lost their homes, their jobs. They've been forced to rearrange their working lives in ways that they had never asked for. Pensions have evaporated. All these are constraints that take away people's liberty to be in charge of their own life. And it's a direct outcome of the way that we have run financial markets before the crisis. Now they have evolved over these past years. So what the crisis has made clear is that we, people in the Netherlands, people in Europe, and indeed people across the OECD world, the industrialized countries, have become in many ways very dependent on these elusive financial markets that they have started to guide our choices and our lives in many ways. If you want to use a very simple and evocative phrase, we realize these days that European societies, among others, have become addicted to credit. And as much as we would like to sever that link between our economy and this infusion, constant infusion of credit into them, we find that actually we can't really sever that link. We're still dependent on the financial sector to inject credit into our economy. We're still dependent on the financial sector to provide debt to government. And that is an enormous constraint on the European people to give shape to Europe and their own policy. Now, as was mentioned before, what we may be facing in the weeks and months to come is potentially the biggest overhaul of the architecture of Europe that we've seen since the 1950s. And that's no mean thing. Unfortunately, the decisions that are being taken right now and will be taken in the days to come are being taken with financial markets breathing down politicians. In that sense, that is quite the opposite of the ideal of deliberation that you would want for the momentous decisions that are about to be made. Politicians will anxiously wake up on Monday morning. They will be reading the charts of stock markets, of bond markets, to see whether the solution that they have come up with is well received or maybe spells doom for you. Having said that, there are still things that can go wrong this coming weekend and things that can go right this coming weekend. And so if we do not only want quick fixes, but actually a sustainable solution to the predicaments within which Europe finds itself these days, we have to ask, which requirements, tangible, concrete terms, would an order that emerges from this crisis have to fulfill to deserve our approval? That is what I want to talk to you about in the remaining 30 minutes. And I'll do, though, by going through three facets of the sustainable order that I've talked about. Financial sustainability, economic sustainability, and political sustainability. Let's start with the short term. That's maybe the easiest one. It's become very clear that markets these days are out of kilter. What has been happening in government debt markets, for example, no longer corresponds in any meaningful way to the fundamental strength of the European economy. All the factories that we need to provide ourselves with the material welfare that we are enjoying these days, they're all still in place. Europe is as capable today of providing its own people with that material wealth as it was 2 years ago. That's all still there. So as far as that is concerned, I think it's quite fair to ask governments, or public authorities, to step in quite forcefully in this crisis and put an end to what has been a spiraling out of control, if you will, financial market. The European Central Bank, never mind protestations from Berlin that this is going to spell doom, needs to intervene in financial markets to put an end. And I have confidence that if a sensible and meaningful agreement on some kind of fiscal pact is going to emerge this coming weekend at the European summit, that then the European Central Bank will do its bit to calm down the market. The other bit that is talked about quite a lot has to do with putting financial markets themselves in work, financial regulation, which is actually my own home territory. And indeed, if you look at the different proposals that have been made, and some of them have already been implemented, there are quite a few sensible thoughts among them. Bigger bank buffers that protect them against losses and insolvency. Curbs on excessive bonuses that have provided incentives to people working in the financial sector, CEOs and traders alike, to take excessive risks, knowing that should losses occur, those can be put on the backs of them. Maybe getting some grip on credit rating agencies. These days, again, much in the news, in light of the announcement that potentially even the strongest of the European economists are up for a downgrade by Standard & Poor's and Moody's. But truth be told, these kinds of measures are the old-style regulation that we had before the crisis, but then just a little bit tightened up. And I think we need more. I think we actually need a new philosophy in financial regulation if we want a sustainable financial system. What this crisis has shown us is that financial markets, if they're let loose, tend to dig their own grave. Now, that is something that, to be fair, we can't afford. There is something in financial markets that John Maynard Keynes, among others, was very keenly aware of and that we've rediscovered that you could call reflexivity. And I think it's an important concept to get into. What does financial market reflexivity mean? It means that what investors, credit rating agencies, what market actors do, they don't only observe what is happening and they don't only form their assessments of what the future might hold, but by this very assessment, they shape the future. If the players on bond market, on stock market, think that everything is going to be great, they'll put all their money into, whether it's Greek government debt, particular corporations, say Philips, then that act in itself, coming out of the positive expectation, will, for example, provide the Greek government temporarily with the means to continue on a path toward economic growth. If the expectation is negative and all these funds are withdrawn, then as in a self-fulfilling prophecy, Greek or a corporation like Philips will see its own demise. Financial markets don't only assess the future, they shape the future. In that sense, they're reflective. Now, that gives rise to both upward and downward spiral. There is no anchor that somehow ties what financial markets do to sort of felt internal equilibrium. They can spiral both ways. Way too far upward, and as we're experiencing now, way too far down. Now, what that means in a nutshell is that the provision of debt, whether household debt, corporate debt, government debt, to an economy, begets the creation of yet more debt. Because you infuse debt, economy does great, and you have the feeling that providing debt to an economy, there's nothing wrong with that. And so you give more. Just like we've seen here in Dutch housing market. Provide a lot of mortgages, housing prices go up, nobody defaults, and yet more credit is provided. Until also Dutch housing markets have spun totally out of control. So debt makes even more debt look sustainable, even though ultimately that cannot be the case, and we find ourselves in a massive pond. Now, if you put the creation of credit in the hand of a financial sector that earns its money with creating more credit, that is more debt, then you're in store for trouble. So limiting the supply of credit somehow, putting ties on the urge of financial marketplace to provide credit to whoever can take it, is a sensible idea. And it's something that is actually starting to be discussed. But it's not enough. Why? Because there's not only an excessive supply of credit in the European economies, there's also an excessive demand. And getting this demand right is something that ties to the second theme, namely what I would call finding economic sustainability for Europe. I mentioned John Maynard Keynes earlier. John Maynard Keynes had, as one of its key insights, that the demand side of the economy is crucial. If you want economic growth, you somehow have to make sure that there are people and corporations around who have the money in the pockets to buy the stuff that comes out of our factory. And if the most competitive producers, there's nobody to buy the things they make, then you won't have economic growth. Now, the nasty thing he found was that the rich in a society have the irritating habit to save more than they earn. And money disappears from the circular flow of money in the economy. So where does that extra demand come from that buys the things that the rich won't buy because they have enough money and just put it in a savings account? For some countries, the answer has been to sell it to other countries, to export. Is that going to be a sustainable model for Europe? Well, no. In the global pyramid of development, countries like those of the European Union stand at the very top. And it's actually those further down, the China, the Indias of this world that are trying to climb the ladder of economic development by exporting to us products that are manufactured with cheap labor. The idea that Europe could get back on a sustainable path towards economic growth by having a constant export surplus for the rest of the world, now that the US, as the consumer of last resort, is imploding, is ridiculous. That is not going to be the answer. Of course, we've tried other options in history. One would be simply to print money. 1920s, my own home country in Germany, that has had completely devastating effects, but also in other places in the world, simply starting the printing press as a way to try to keep economic growth up is surely unsustainable. It leads to inflation and ultimately often economic devastation. Printing money is also not an option. Once the post-war reconstruction boom was over, we tried yet another thing, government borrowing. Led into the 1970s, at stagflation, governments finding that they had to borrow ever more money, not only to keep economies afloat, but also to be able to repay yesterday's debt. Clearly unsustainable. Now that has, in the 1980s, led to yet another version of trying to keep economies afloat through credit. Namely, not having governments borrow the money, but having private individuals, households, corporations borrow. Some people in my profession, political economy, have called that privatized Keynesian. So it's still debt providing the demand for what's being produced, but it's not public debt, it's private debt. Now, where that leads is something that you have been able to witness. U.S. real estate markets, remember 4 years back we were talking about the subprime crisis, which was a real estate sector that is ultimately unproductive, used as an ATM to finance economic growth. Clearly unsustainable. So the question then is, what could actually be a sustainable source of demand for the European economies that does not rely on the constant buildup of debt somewhere, with corporations, with households, or with government? You see people starting to wonder, okay, so what is the golden bullet? It's not something that is very popular still, because the only thing that I see as a sustainable answer to that question is a redistribution that is financed through taxes. Not popular, I'll tell you right away. But having gone through all the other options, I do not see where European growth could come from if it wasn't for taking money that is simply sitting somewhere in bank and wealth that is stocked up elsewhere and that is not being used, that does not have the fact of stimulating economic growth. What that means is that we would have to address, through forms of redistribution, three imbalances that have built up in the European economy over the past, say, 20 years. The first one is social inequality. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, the Rich Countries Club, came out with a report a few days ago on inequality in OECD society between rich and poor. And even though the OECD had always been brandished as a bastion of neoliberal thinking, here it came with a report that rang the alarm bells on the rising gap between rich and poor all over the OECD world. And the OECD, again, this bastion of putatively neoliberal thinking, urged governments to address these growing social inequalities, not because of some clemency, some act of charity, because it understood itself that sustainable growth needs a balance between different strata of society, not only to keep the social peace, but also to keep economic growth on a sustainable level. Make a similar kind of argument about imbalances that have grown not within countries, but actually between countries in the European Union. The Germans, the Dutch, the Finns have thrived with their economic growth over the trade deficits at the southern periphery of Europe. Germany's economic fortunes were directly tied to Portugal's, Italy's, to Greece's economic misfortune. That was financed by debt, the build-up of government debt, Portuguese case, more the build-up of private debt, same in Ireland, clearly unsustainable. So whether you like it or not, if you want to keep the European economic order open to trade across the continent, and you want to do that without an excessive build-up of debt somewhere, then you will need to find a way to channel demand from where the accumulation of wealth is happening now, northern European countries like the Netherlands, to countries elsewhere. Again, I do not say that because I think that we should feel sorry for the Greeks. Maybe we should, but that's not the point. The point is, what will be a sustainable model on which economic Europe can thrive? Of course, alternatives stand in the room. The breakup of the euro, for example. And maybe if we go back to the mid-1990s, we come to the conclusion that the arguments in favor of introducing a single currency were slightly overblown, and the warnings against the downsides of a single currency were not properly heeded. I think that that's probably correct. That does not mean, to my mind, that we could simply turn back the clock, pretend it was 1995, and choose a different composition of the Eurozone that only comprises the Austrians, the Germans, the Dutch, and so on and so forth. As of 2011, the Dutch economy, as all the other economies within the Eurozone, have completely adjusted to the presence of a single currency and an open trading order. turning back that clock would come with massive adjustment costs. We're not in 95, and we cannot make that decision over again. The costs, again, would be enormous. What that means, then, is that the only choice that we really have, to my mind, is more integration of some sort. Now, that, of course, is something that with many European citizens these days is not exactly popular. Germans, for right or wrong, think that their prosperity is about to be taken away. The Greek are loath to cede on a permanent basis yet more power to Brussels, which they see as the source of all the evil that has descended on the Greek society. So the question arises then, how could we achieve more European integration in a way that is also politically sustainable, the third pillar of the sustainability that I'm talking about. Political sustainability of a more integrated European order needs to combine two things. A European institutional arrangement that is effective in getting things done, but that also enjoys the kind of legitimacy that you talked about earlier, that enjoys the support of the European people. Now, we know that different facets of economic policy interact quite strongly with each other. Monetary policy, fiscal policy, taxation policy, financial market regulation, and different programs of spending, whether that's structural funds, regional funds, welfare spending, now still mostly at the national level. What that means is that if we want to integrate these different functions that are inevitably interdependent, then we will need a strong set of European institutions. And one of these pillars will have to be an executive in the form of a European Commission, of one sort or another, assuming many of the powers that are necessary to coordinate these kinds of policies well. But that's, of course, only one. That's getting some kind of real power to get things done. The other one is the legitimacy. So what kind of representation, then, would actually put people, the European citizens, in charge and in control of this machinery that would emerge in Brussels? The European Parliament, to my mind, is the only institution capable of doing it. It's the only credible source on checks and balances on the different institutions that we have on the European level. As I mentioned before, these days, this kind of pro-integration thinking is not exactly popular with European citizens. But once you start thinking about it in terms of what is going to put European citizens more in the driving seat, national parliaments clawing back power to themselves or giving it to the European Parliament, then I think if European citizens want more control of their own life, more control of the economic and political circumstances in Europe, then the European Parliament, with all the imperfections that it may have, will be more of an answer to gain control over your own vital life than national parliaments are likely to be. So European countries this coming weekend will have to choose. Because EU light, what we've had so far, integration light, no longer is an option. Sustainable order will have to mean a refusal to keep muddling through at some point and actually make the tough choices. I hope, personally, that the European leaders will get their act together, if you will, and craft a political order that is capable of being legitimate and making those tough choices. Whether that happens is, of course, an open question. I started early in my talk by saying that when I cycle to university in the morning, I pass Pino. And I'll do the same tomorrow morning. When I cycle by and the European summit is about to start, then I'll ask myself, will the European leaders assembled in Brussels be able to craft a political order that is going to be financially sustainable, that will put Europe on a path towards sustainable economic growth, and that will at least take the first steps towards installing a political order in Europe that is both effective and legitimate? Because these three things, if you want them to be sustainable, can only be had together. But I think if they manage to do that, at least take the first meaningful step in that direction, then I think they will actually have served citizens in the way that I interpret Spinoza and what it says there on his monument. because they will have delivered European citizens into a new economic and political order in which these same European citizens can be architects of their own European fortune, both individually and collectively. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, we of course want to know whether Daniel tomorrow morning is actually going to cycle past the statue or decides to just stay in bed, because it's very hard to come up with a positive answer. And in order to avoid you staying in bed tomorrow morning, I hope that you are, because this is not a bilateral discussion between Daniel and me, or maybe Sherp, because Daniel is hinting at the European Parliament, and I know that's in your heart. But we would like to share the discussion with you. So I would like actually to ask, and look, there's already arms. Shall I limit my role then to walk and give people the microphone? Is that an idea? Okay. The first, can you stand up, tell us your name, and formulate your question or make your remark?
Yes, my name is Edward, and my question is about what you said. You said the national parliaments or the national governments can't make it, so the European citizen is better served if a new political order will be created at the European level. So then you would get a more legitimate political order than we have right now. But shouldn't this transfer from the national level to the European level be legitimate as well? Therefore, democratically elected, or and the problem we have right now is that it seems like most European citizens, at least in the north, wouldn't be in favor of this transfer to the European level. So then this transfer wouldn't be legitimate itself, even though you might get a legitimate political order. I don't know. You understand my question, right? Isn't there a problem there?
I'm not advocating, that this is kind of solution that will be shoved down the throats of European citizens. Not at all. What I'm saying is that we need to start thinking in terms, and I think that European citizens need to start thinking in terms of, which kind of political order actually puts them in charge. There is no way that you or I or anybody else can guarantee that we'll make the right choice. But if I had my pick, then I'd say, yes, let's go for national referenda, all fine. But then I want there only to be two options there. Serious form of European integration and no thing. Because what we have right now is something that's unsustainable. It's not going to be that. And that, I think, is something that has so far completely hampered debate, that people somehow think that what they think has been the kind of situation they've lived in over the past 5, 10, 15 years, that is an option that's on the table for the next 20. And that's not the case. When the Greek referendum was announced, I was all for it. I thought, yes, let's talk about it. Take your pick. What do you want? You want this, with all its imperfections, this austerity package and stay within the euro? Or do you say, no, we don't want it and we want to go? But just leaving things as they are is not an option. There is a chance, a very big chance, that citizens of the northern European countries will not think that way. I think it's not for their own benefit. So, to my mind, that is an important mission that we have here, to start a debate about, okay, what are actually the options that are on the table, because the status quo is not one of them.
But I think with the Lisbon Treaty, with regards to referenda, we've all seen what happens then with the constitutional treaty, And when it comes to, you should give them the choice, but you still say that you hope that the coming 2 days, these world leaders, even though Merkel and Rutte, they are in favor of European integration and will support it there, even though you know that their population is actually against. So I see that there is a divergence there.
There clearly is a divergence there. I think the task for European leaders, again, is not to shove something down the throat of their own people. But, if you think in terms of this ballot that you would ideally present to citizens at the end of the day, then, the first step to be taken is to hammer out what is actually going to be on that ballot. What are the options that we have? What would, the more Europe order look like? And then in the second step, you can say, okay, take your pick. What is it going to be? And to my mind, this is the first step that is going to be taken. if it will involve serious treaty changes, then I think, you know, we already have a number of countries within the European Union where some kind of potential action, a referendum, will be necessary to get those adopted. So clearly going to be in the minds of European leaders. But I think, you know, there is a fairly complex relationship between leadership, also leadership of your own people, and then, you know, at crucial junctures, getting back the legitimation. It's an uneasy constellation, you know, as far as it's concerned, I totally agree with you.
Okay. Does this relate to the previous question? Because what I would like to do is, instead of zigzagging between all kinds of different topics, I would like to first ask if there's someone who likes to follow up on this point. And then if, you know, if this is discussed, then we can move on to the next point. Is there someone who likes to follow up to this point?
I'd like to be to speak out as the advocate of the devil, because of course I represent the European Parliament, and thank you so much for your very interesting talk, and I really appreciate it. And but I mean, we are having these discussions, of course, on a day-to-day business. But where it comes to democratic legitimation on the European integration process, the question on the European Parliament is vital, of course. And here, although I fully agree with your premises that European Parliament is the pitch where democratic checks and balances for European citizens are at stake, and where they could go for their rights once, and to check the power, to control power in the European power arena or political arena, the key issue is at stake: is European democracy possible? Is the European theater fit for European democracy? I ask this question because at the ratification process of the Treaty of Lisbon, which has been mentioned just the other minute, the national governments, and notably the Bundesverfassungsgericht in your own country, stated a very interesting position. They said, look, for real European democracy, you need a European demos, a European people. And there is no such thing. There is not a European people. So if there is not a common understanding on the issue and the notion that we form a European people, right, with its thinking, with its with the issues of identification, identity, issues north-south, structural imbalances between north and south, east and west, then if there's no European demos, then there is no European democracy. Ergo, you cannot have checks and balances on a European level. Ergo, the real democratic legitimation is in your own country, in bicameralism, in the Bundestag. Ergo, every step towards handing over sovereignty to a supranational level needs, as of that moment, needs to be checked in the Bundestag. Now, that's a very serious statement. So this statement is still up in the air, and I fully agree with you that the European Parliament should be the place for real democracy, but there are serious doubts on this statement in very important countries, in the European Union, notably in your own country.
To cut a long story short, I think the Germans need to make up their mind. I mean, you know, as I appreciate the respect that they, or I myself, being a German, you know, have for their own constitutional law, but if there is the political will in Germany to amend the political order within which they find themselves, I think that is possible. 200 years ago, it wasn't obvious to people here in South Holland, you know, that they were part of the same demos as people maybe in Maastricht or in Leeuwarden, or as people in Massachusetts, whether they think they're part of the same demos as people in California or Oregon. Now they are, but it's not as though that is some kind of a natural given. There is an evolution involved in that process as well. Germany, the Bavarian, the Prussian, who have, you know, that was a historical process that brought people together. And there are numerous obstacles. You mentioned some of them, you mentioned some others. I'm not saying that it's easy, but I'm saying anything short of that is not going to yield a sustainable political order. And so we have to rise to the occasion, must do what's possible and what's necessary if we want to overcome this crisis. If we stop short of doing that, fine. But then don't think that 10, 15, 20 years from now, you'll still have something that vaguely looks like what we have now. Is that going to be gone?
Richard Griffith, one of your colleagues, Norman Davies, predicts the collapse of the European Union. And he adds something. He says, because Sharp is actually saying we are trapped. We are involved in a process of different scales. And you also mentioned it in your article on which you base your speech. We are trapped. And actually, it's not that bad that there might be a collapse, because after the collapse of a polity, there will be a new unraising. And maybe then the demos urgency is revitalized. Is that something that I don't want to dramatize, of course. I actually study dramatization on political agendas. I don't want to influence you. But is this something that, is it connecting to your point, or am I making too much a jump now? So we keep you, I know your face, so I'll get to you. Is your point connecting to... Okay, yeah, it's intellectual exercise. Huh? It's not for nothing.
Okay, thank you. First, I'll comment on the opening remarks. You mentioned about Angela Merkel and Sarkozy. There shouldn't be any fear about who is taking role as a leader within the European Union. If you want to promote, if you want to have a successful European Union, then you need leaders over there. And fortunately, Angela Merkel could emerge as a very good, strong, sustainable leader. She deserves compliments that she saved somehow, some way, the European Union and the unity. Now, second, I'm coming on yours. Definitely, you also deserve, I mean, compliments. You mentioned about economic, financial, and political sustainability. It's amazing to listen. You presented fantastically. I was thinking about that if any country within the European Union is thinking about that, to hell with other countries, they are the weaker economies, we can survive as a country like Netherlands or someone else, and to get rid of the European Union, a strong European Union, then they are living in fool's paradise. So my question comes to you now. Netherlands, the mortgage debts, which you mentioned, are 3 times than the general mortgage percentage of the European Union. So it's extremely alarming. You mentioned about distribution of the wealth and supply demand economic rule, definitely. So what would you suggest the Netherlands and the financial market of the Netherlands and the economists to take measures to save them from this disaster, which seems to be possible because of the mortgage debts? Thank you.
You started in the air, but you moved a little bit away from the topic. and I want to, you know, I don't want you to put you. Do you like to address the first part of the question or the second half of the question?
I'm a political economist, so like the mortgage debt kinds of things, you know, that's really my home turf. So can I?
And it's a, you know, and I also feel like we are all part of the problem, right? When it comes to mortgages, I don't know. Do you have a mortgage?
Sustainability. Sorry. What will be the source of the fundamentals, the basic, to while confronting you, that you said there are no people in the European Union, which I say there are people in the European Union, because all these parliamentarians, they are elected by the people from the European Union. So they are representing them. So do you think that if this thing continues and South and North debate gets stronger position, that this European Union will remain as it is today?
Okay. First, the mortgage bit, because I think that is important. Now, that, you know, the Dutch government's real estate policy is nuts and has been so for quite a while. I think, you know, it's these days an open secret. You know, economists, you know, from way on the left to way to the right, you know, they don't agree about anything other than that the tax deductibility of mortgage interest, you know, should be abolished sooner rather than later. You know, that I think, you know, almost anybody agrees on. When I thought this through, right, you know, it's always easy to point your finger at all sorts of things and say, oh, this is wrong and that's unsustainable and that's unsustainable. You know, that's the easy bit. And I thought, like, okay, so what would then be the alternative source of growth and the alternative source of, you know, this kind of redistribution that you need? Again, it's not about charity. It's about just providing the demand and the economy so they can keep growing. The only answer that I could come up with is that you tax wealth that does not contribute to keeping consumption levels up. What that means is that taxing consumption in the form of value-added tax is nuts because you need that consumption, right, to keep your economy growing. What you want to tax is wealth that does not contribute to consumption. So what that means is, of course, the counter-argument that you get and that we have been getting for 3 decades of financial globalization now is that you can't do that because as soon as you start taxing wealth, then that wealth will just disappear to Switzerland or to Luxembourg or to the Cayman Islands or wherever, right? So you have to tax something that is immobile and that was us consuming at the supermarket. Now, I think that that's a phony argument. I think if you want to, you can tax wealth. But you know, then for starters, you know, if you think that mobile wealth cannot be taxed as impractical, be taxed, then unfortunately I don't see any other way out than taxing immobile wealth. And that starts, for example, with real estate here. Again, I don't say that because I think we need to help the poor people and, you know, make them consume more cheaply, because otherwise I don't see where the demand should come from if debt is not the answer. Now, the second half of your question, is it likely that the European people will still subscribe to some kind of common democratic order? I think if you know, ask your average Greek citizen on the streets of Athens these days, you know, whether he looks forward, you know, to more centralization of powers in Brussels, chances are that you get no for an answer.
Wait, I have someone who is informed about this.
Yes, I have to agree that this is the case in Greece right now. So it's I didn't make the question because you covered the majority of the points that I would like to. Compliment on the topics you have mentioned. I don't know whether you have read some articles of Mr. Varoufakis.
I don't think.
He's a Greek professor in economics, and he has to cope with, has proceeded with a modest proposal about how the Europeans should deal with the crisis. And there were 3 steps. He's recognizing that the crisis had a twin character. On the one hand, it was the problem of a budgetary discipline from the southern countries. On the other hand, it was the banking sector that had accumulated all the debt from the crisis from the southern periphery. So he comes up with the conclusion that the Europeans dealt with the one part of the crisis, mm-hmm. the budgetary discipline of the southern countries, and they did not touch upon the banking sector. The second, that's why the solution he proposed had to deal with the recapitalization of the banks that have accumulated the whole debt. This was the step one. The second step had to deal with recognizing which debt of these countries, the southern countries, is sustainable and which is not. Because I cannot force the German or the Dutch people, in the discussion of the Eurobonds, I cannot urge the German or the Dutch people to pay for my own debt building the Eurobonds, because this is the case. But in case they regard that there is a certain amount of money, of debt, that they could pay for, if they regard that there is a part of the Greek debt that is sustainable, and this part of the debt is compatible with the Maastricht criteria, it's till 60%, let's say. This 60% from the whole countries could be built up on a Eurobond platform. And the third part of the proposal has to deal with the utilization of the European Investment Bank for the fallen states, like Greece, like Italy maybe, Spain, Portugal, which could be utilized in order to not to redistribute that, I mean, not putting more taxes on the German and the Dutch people to bring money on the Greeks, rather than making investments more helpful for the Dutch and the Germans in Greece and contributing to the recycling of the money in this region. So I have to, in order to complete my comment, I would like to say that I was really fascinated by the way you're thinking, because it was not something, it was not entangled in the whole monetary conceptualization we have built European Union upon. It was something, it had more differentiated character that I had expected. So this was my point I would like to make.
Do you like to address, or would you like to continue answering the question about democracy?
I don't know what you'd like to comment on the proposal that that he made, these three steps. I don't know whether you think that they are sustainable or not.
I think the third one is interesting. You know, I think they're all interesting, but I think, you know, the third one, using the European Investment Bank, because, of course, you know, from what I've told you so far, you know, that should already, you know, set off a red light flashing again, because that's, you know, lending money and borrowing money. The thing here is, of course, you know, there is then, in that sense, I think, if more nuance is required, I think there is a difference between sustainable debt in the sense that it's sustainable, either because it doesn't lead to an automatic spiraling out of control, that's one thing, and also because it's actually used for some kind of productive investment. Right, so debt to keep consumption levels up by channeling it into our pockets directly or indirectly through governments that borrow to finance welfare state spending, but that is unsustainable because it doesn't actually lead to anything. If you borrow, in contrast, to invest in some kind of productive capacity, then that is a completely different story. I don't think you want to rely to that on that too much because of all the vagaries of being able to anticipate. If now you start building factories on a massive scale, whether 30 years from now, well, they'll be as productive as right now, you hope they will be. It's kind of a, you know, risky strategy. But I think there is a difference there. So to say, you know, you can use an institution like that to this kind of an end. You know, if you think back, for example, to the Marshall Plan, well, in many ways, that had, you know, not dissimilar characteristics from what you were describing. It was good for Europe, and it was good for the U.S. So in that sense, I think there is definitely something to that that could be considered.
Okay, not forgotten.
Well, by now my question, I think, has been partially already answered, but I was just wondering what would be your proposition, how to get that money of rich people? Basically, you are saying that sustainable growth could be reached by redistribution. Would it be through some adjusted and coordinated fiscal policies in European level?
I think it would have to involve, I think there are two components here. There is a, say, if you will, a vertical and horizontal component. There is a question of coordination here, certainly across the Eurozone countries, and I think that's something where, at least from what we hear from Mr. Merkel and Mr. Sarkozy, there has always been talk of some kind of, for example, harmonized corporate tax, has often been discussed, and I think there is some movement on that front. But I think the second point is that you do have to rejig important parts of where you tax in the economy, you know, where the flow of money as it, you know, goes through the economy, where you say, okay, this is the point where we tax that money. So it's not even about increasing necessarily taxation, but making sort of like a taxation regime that encourages investment and consumption rather than saving money and, you know, lending them the money to the U.S. government or lending it, you know, to somebody else at the far end of the world or investing it in gold. Right? So if you have a relatively increasing value-added tax and at the margin, you're discouraging spending for consumption and you're relatively encouraging, for example, buying gold or something like that. For us, I think you should be doing exactly the opposite. So it's not necessarily only saying, you know, tax rich people much more, but I think, you know, that will be part of a strategy that tries to think of, you know, where is the money come from that sustains certain growth. That's the way I am. Yeah, I mean, and no sustainable economic growth with taxation that fits for that. Again, you know, I said it before and I say it again because it's become so unpopular these days. This is not a call for charity. I mean, I'm not, you know, necessarily so compassionate with the poor. But John Maynard Keynes, that was what he was all about. That was one of his key insights from the Great Depression. If you don't have the consumption there, then you'll get deflation and just, you know, a spiraling down of the economy, which is bad for everybody, not just for the poor, also for the rich.
In 1989, Peter Hall published an edited volume with the title The Political Power of Economic Ideas, and it was about Keynesianism. And I think that your policy position, if I may call it like this, we have two elements in the discussion. I would like to try to discuss them a little bit more. The policy idea in Daniel's introduction is how to redistribute welfare. So that could be the political power of economic ideas. But then the question first is, how do we want to do that? And there was, you know, a wary young man being left, not living in Amsterdam, where everyone is left wing, of course. And you live in The Hague, maybe, or in Leiden. What? So that is, of course, an issue. What support for policy?
Marco, where does Leiden figure on your? So if Amsterdam is left and Leiden, how does that fit?
Well, it depends
in?
On where you are in Leiden.
Oh, God. That's too nuanced for me.
It's a microcosmos of ideology. But I would like to go discuss a little bit more this substantive redistribution issue, and then the last part of the debate, I would like to move more towards the political representation question about how to move forward with European institutions if we want to keep them. So who would like, and I'm another man, I was hinting at some lady mixing in the debate, because otherwise I know that economic and fiscal policy is a very masculine topic, but you're not sitting here for nothing. So who would take up the challenge and ask or make a remark or a point about this? Now, don't tell me that there's no one. Is there? No, but Luz, I can give you the microphone. You will have a question about the policy, right?
I won't have a question about economic policy, but I will have, it's just a clarification question actually. There was a statement in your presentation that I was quite struck by when you said that somehow when we delegate to the European Parliament, that the European citizens or citizens of national states will become more in control. Mm-hmm. And this could be perhaps perceived as a controversial statement. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could elaborate, maybe more clarify what you meant by more control and what makes European Parliament a special representative body where citizens all of a sudden will be more in control.
Yeah, no, very good question. I think it's an important point, again, that European citizens need to wrap their head around. If you think that there is a trade-off, and you know, this has been theorized in many ways, you know, so if we have different scales representation, so you know, I don't know, like we living in one neighborhood, we could have our own neighborhood committee, and then as a municipality, and then as a province, and then as a national statesman, and so forth. Of course, you know, the higher you move up on that scale, the further removed, you know, that representative body will be from you, and the less likely it's going to be that it will really mirror your specific preferences, right? The European, if we're lucky, demos of what, 350 million people, you know, in your neighborhood block, I don't know, maybe there's like 350. So on that sense, if you only look at that axis, then you say the further removed that representative body is, you know, the less well represented you as an individual citizen will be. But I think the yardstick should be a different one. Namely, that directness of representation of you all should be discounted by, you know, the real world impact that decisions by that particular body can have. You know, it's all nice and fine by the Luxembourg people or by the Greek people to think, oh, that's so terrible. You know, Brussels, you know, they're doing all these things, as if the government in Athens or the Greek parliament could, out of, you know, by its own device, completely change the world in which Greece finds itself. They cannot. You know, it's still a choice that you can make, but it's not as though if you say, well, let's repatriate decision-making to national parliaments, then all of a sudden, then you're in control of your own destiny. So you'll still be whipped around by all sorts of economic forces and flows that just push your country this way or that way, right? And so far, we're only talking about Europe. We're not talking about the rest of the world, but we're not talking about China, we're not talking about India, we're not talking about Brazil, about Russia, about the United States. So if you say we want somehow to be in control, then I think the best way to be in control, in spite of the fact that we're removed from that body in Brussels, is if we find a way of deciding things collectively, taking a stand collectively rather than everybody for themselves, where people find that actually they can't really change the circumstances on which they find themselves. That's what I meant, how, you know, indeed, you know, counterintuitive in a way, but actually puts you more in charge if you do things collectively rather than on a small scale.
No, I don't think that it's actually counterintuitive. Hence, I wanted you to clarify a little bit of that position, because it's a little bit of an economies of scale argument, right? You're going to get more by sort of associating with larger body that will have more impact generally. But then you probably run, it's not about the remoteness of that institution from you in terms of distance or geography, but it's more about political parties and how political parties will actually feel that, you know, where they are on the representativeness scale and how much they have incentive to provide you these options, right? So I think it's more about having a more integrated political system that goes along with it than a sort of a, you know, a distance of sort of derived representation and, you know, these economies of scale argument, if I understand it correctly.
I think there are two issues at scale. My first one, I think you said the keyword yourself already, that's about incentive, right? And, you know, political parties, you know, just as any other bureaucratic and or entrepreneurial organization, they're very good at reacting to incentives. So if all of a sudden to be successful as the Greens or the Liberals or the Conservatives, you really need to get your act together on a European level, because it's either that or you just perish, then I'm sure they'll be pretty quick. You know, if that is where the power resides and you need to Europeanize as a political movement or party, you know, to be able to thrive, then people will do that. If it doesn't take that, you know, then you go on in your national way. You know, something that we partially still see right now, right? You know, where still, national parliaments are the most important arenas, you know, and say the SPD in Germany, the Social Democratic Party, thinks of itself, you know, in spite of all the protestation of the country, first and foremost as the SPD, and then there's the Party of European Socialists, but that's really something that's, you know, remote in the shadow, because national elections matter. That's an incentive factor that they react to, and, you know, rightly so. If that were changed, I think you would quickly see a readaptation of the party. The second thing is, you said, well, it's not really about geographical remoteness, agreed. I think an important aspect that we haven't mentioned yet so far is, say, for example, you know, diversity among the European people. It's not only, but then again, if you come to think of it, you also find massive diversity within national societies right now of all stripes and colors. You know, political diversity, cultural diversity, economic diversity, you know, and that works, you know, more or less. So, you know, diversity is something that democratic systems accommodate right now, and I think they could also accommodate potential union.
Yeah, even in Belgium, there is a government now, right?
Yes.
Okay, we have 15 minutes, and I would like to go a little bit more in depth with you about these challenges of representation. No taxation without representation. Can you also reverse to this? Can you also say no representation without more taxation and control? That's the six-pack proposal that is being discussed and recycled in the European summit discussions. I would like to add to the discussion about democracy in Europe and the future of the European Parliament. Is it a siren call that Daniel makes for more strength, or is it something that, yeah?
I'm going to challenge you a little bit. I actually agree with everything that you've said regarding the economic policy, and I think you're right about the need for more political integration and all those things. However, I'm not convinced that the European Parliament is a sustainable solution, although I'm not sure if one exists, right? So I would challenge you by saying, I don't think you're really arguing, your proposal really suggests a sustainable alternative, but one that buys the EU a lot more time to develop this demos, right? And I think this demos trap is a bigger problem than I think your presentation lets on, in the sense that parliaments can be a huge source for disunity as well, in the sense of now it provides this kind of centralized location where politics can be dramatized in a way that can actually lead to more disunity, right? So as an American, you mentioned how someone in Massachusetts now considers themselves part of the same American demos as someone from New York. A better example would be Connecticut and New York, because one of the reasons why the U.S. left the Articles of Confederation in the first place was that New York wanted to invade Connecticut. So the idea was, is when you talk about when this demos happened in the U.S. case, it really happened with the Civil War, right? It wasn't and that Civil War was largely begun on the basis of an election to our national body that left one particular region feeling permanently not in control of their future, right? And this comes to how the political parties are organized and how these interests happen. So I would argue that your proposal probably puts you into a position where you're now into like the U.S. Constitution phase after the Articles of Confederation, and you're waiting for your next big crisis to or some evolutionary process to create this demos. So I applaud it, but I also think that the concerns about the demos trap are far more serious than I think your presentation lets on, and that it just buys us time for more troubled roads ahead. So I'd like to hear your response to that.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're right. And the other examples that I mentioned, I mean, Germany, one of the cases that I know best, German unification, not reunification, but German unification in 1871, that came in very handy, to say the very least, that you could, strike up a war with the French, to kind of like make that happen. And as you say, the list of examples where it needed some kind of external threat to bond people together or to weld them together, that list is very long. Does that make it less likely that something similar is going to happen in Europe now? Yes, I think that is correct. But when you say, well, then you're waiting for an existential crisis to make that happen, that I think we have already. I mean, that crisis, unfortunately, it's not there in the citizens' mind yet. But I think a moment must come. I find it difficult to imagine otherwise when, continuing on the road that we've been traveling so far, also in the minds of citizens, is no longer an option. And that, I think, is something that so far with the crisis that we faced, first the financial crisis, then the economic crisis, and now this political crisis, has been one of the major mistakes with the hindsight that many politicians have made. If you think of the economic crisis, politicians always thought that their job was to calm everything down. Right? To tell everybody, oh, it's okay, it's not that bad, no need to worry. Because, they thought that in the margin, they could make a difference to market sentiment. That's a plausible gamble. If you can pull that off, talk about this reflexivity, the importance of expectations, if you can pull that off, calm everything down, then you've done a good job. But if you find that you can't do that, then all of a sudden you're in a trap. Because things are really starting to go bad. And up until yesterday, you've been telling your voters that you were in control, that everything was fine, they needn't worry. And now you realize, okay, maybe time has come that I start telling them the truth. But then you need to turn around 180 degrees. At the kind of Merkel trap, Rutte was in a similar kind of situation, where you've sort of like, by trying to gamble on this one role, you find yourself that you can't really live up to that other role, which is making clear to your own citizens that emergency is really high. Doesn't change the fact, that at some point, people will realize one way or another that a stark choice has to be made. And then I cannot do more than hope that for Europe it won't take the war to weld people together. Maybe you're right. I think the odds are not terribly good. But, faith in, sort of like at least, some modicum of reason in people hasn't left me sufficiently to think that it's not at least possible for people to come out of this country.
Okay. First, are you studying European integration history? Exactly what I would like someone with a historical perspective, addressing Brendan's question, your answer. So could you?
I think Professor Griffiths has a better historical perspective than I do. But I would like to support your idea that it's very difficult to create a demos and a proper legitimation of very difficult decisions being made at a European level. Now, you say national governments cannot address the financial situation right now. They will just be floated around on the by the financial markets. Europe can, you say? I think it's still difficult for Europe to act that way. One of the suggestions made lately has been a European taxation on financial transactions. I'm not sure whether Europe can confront the financial markets and tame them in that way. But considering they would, then that really needs the support of the European populace. And a European demos is needed for that sort of action. There is no demos. For demos, you need time. You need a European public sphere, which isn't there. Everything is still looked at from a national perspective. So there is no perspective or no real view on European demos being created. There's no, I can't see it coming. So we have a little bit of problem of legitimacy considering European Parliament not being a way of legitimizing Europe. Yet we need fast action to address these issues. Now, we have a problem of demos, and we have a problem of can Europe really deal with this situation? I would like you to hear your views on that.
Okay. Let's stick with the European demos for a second. See, I don't think the war option. You know, let's skip that for them. I don't think that we necessarily need to wait for that somehow to bubble up out of nowhere. Right? I think there is a leadership role for political leaders, for different political parties taking a stand, for media. I'm not saying that they can just turn around and there is European demo. But these things are institutionalized in particular facets, pockets, dimensions of society. If that's part of what we are talking about today, if in forums such as this, or in the Dutch parliament over there, or different representations of the political parties in the Netherlands, if they came to the conclusion that Europe was really where it's at, and it was either make it or break it, maybe then they could stand up to the Dutch people and say, hey, listen, guys, I think we've got some tough choices to make. The PVV, Geert Wilders, has a fairly clear idea on that. D66, the Liberals, also have a fairly clear idea on that. There are many other parties. Not quite clear. They certainly don't come out and say it's either option A or option B. We're for either A or option B. They're for nothing or something in between. Where I don't think that in between is an option A. Right? So part of our mission, we're also agents in this. Right? You are, I am. So I'm talking to you today saying, well, listen, I think you better start thinking about those choices that you have. If you think of the media, for example, at least in, certain political, societal elites, so I think there is something forming. There. I mean, if you read the Financial Times, these days, the opinion pieces that they have, they're sourced from throughout Europe, even throughout the world. There's different apps that you have these days on your iPhone, Press Europe, for example, that collect in 10 different languages, key articles from media from all over the place. I think there is something happening. There is a demand and a supply, but I think there is this specific role for political leader to realize what situation we're in. And then I think they can not just make it happen out of nowhere, but they can, rather than exclusively focusing on their national publics, see what the choices are, and then actually start telling citizens what it's at.
Yeah, I enjoyed the lecture. Quick question, very much. And as a federalist, I sympathize with the solution. The way there, though, I can't see happening. As these crises go every 2 or 3 months, and there'll be another one in 3 months' time because they're not going to solve it this time round, every time it's ebbing away popular support, not just for Europe, but also for the political system. Popular parties are beginning to lose their base. You can see it as a radicalization on right and left. The solutions being suggested, sending in the hard gang to go and beat up the Greek budget. If I were Greece, I'd never vote for anything European or carrying a European label as long as I live. I just don't see the way forward, and I don't see now is the leap forward to a more federalist structure. I think even an attempt to do that would doom Europe forever. I've got a feeling that what you're going to see is partly in your direction of a small group of countries that are willing to take that move towards a more federal state, and the status quo ante for the rest. And it's probably going to start with Greece at some stage moving out of the euro, and I think it'll be followed by others before this crisis is over.
No, see, I'm not saying that it's likely, and I wouldn't be surprised, Greece maybe, your home country as well, would be part of the EU light club, but I think that EU light club, which exists already now for those countries that are not members of the single currency, will become lighter still. So all I would ask for, if I had my way, was, you know, to present people with that choice. It's not obvious to me that if a minority of countries does decide to go ahead with some kind of Paris-Berlin axis at its center, that the countries that do not decide to join that club, you know, will be much more than, you know, what we now have, for example, in the European Economic Area, something like that, where Norway, say Iceland, you know, they're somehow associated with Switzerland in some respects, or somehow, you know, they're part of this European thing, they're not really in. And I wouldn't be surprised if the countries that don't take the leap towards more integration, fine, it's up to them, it's up to their citizens, but they end up in more that kind of a situation where many of the big questions that are actually all linked up together, you know, will be taken without them. And it's their choice.
Okay. I saw someone with a hand, but you already asked one question, and I would that's okay. It keeps you in case of. But students of European Union history? Okay, and you want to ask a question? okay, not too long.
No, I wanted to bring in, when we talked about Deimos, language, but you already went into that a bit, and not language as an obstacle, because for European Deimos per se, but also through the media, but you already said it takes time to develop, and you already, there is some movement with things like Press Europe and Euronews, which are also subsidized, I think, by the European Commission.
They subsidize all sorts of things, you'd be surprised. Yeah.
No, yeah, I looked some up, but yeah. So, no, I wanted to ask you, like, don't you see, because you made the comparison with United States, but there is a big difference. I mean, it's the obvious thing in every debate. Language, what are you going to do about it?
I think history will have to show whether that really is an obstacle. It could be. Could be that it's, you know, not a causal relationship, but only a correlation. You know, we've had a particular kind of nation-making, you know, many of the examples that have come by. And in those instances, we did see a combination of, you know, growth, or, you know, the coming into being, or the solidification of a common language, as well as a political system. Is that a correlation, or is there really a causal link there? I'm not quite sure. You know, as a political economist, I would still tend to think, even though it's not obvious that I have it at the right end, but, you know, that fairly narrowly defined interests of people will, at the end of the day, trump vague feelings of identity, unless very much at that stake. So I would hope that, you know, if European people realized, you know, that this was really something that was actually close to their heart and mattered to have, see, the thing, you know, I don't need to read Greek. I don't need to be in love with Greek. I don't even need to like Greek food. But if sort of like having food on my table with my family, all of whom speak, you know, Dutch and German, if that depends on me working together politically with those Greek guys over there, then I'm happy to. You know, so could be an obstacle, yes. I'm not sure whether, you know, you can't have some sort of transmission belt, you know, that would take care of that. So, and as you see in this room right here, right now, you know, you and I, we don't have a problem speaking. We communicate perfectly well for our purposes. And back home at the dinner table, we speak another language. Works perfectly fine. Lots of countries, you know, where you have, take a country like India, for example. Does that have a single language? How many does it have? More than 800. Yeah, great democracy. Fine. You know, and, you know, there's many more examples like that. So I don't think, you know, that is necessarily an obstacle. It helps to have a common one, but I don't think it's an essential.
Okay. Happy to give you the floor.
Thank you. Well, maybe moving on to a prospect to next weekend, and also put it a bit more into the world of now, because we're all fantasizing of how it could be and how it should be, but not really how it's gonna be. And I would like to ask you something about your first point. You were saying that the financial market is breathing in the neck of the of all the politicians at the moment. We see Germany, France, the Netherlands being at the urge of devaluation by settlers at wars. On the other hand, we see Europe wanting to control, wanted to check on Standard & Poor's, Moody's, if they are doing their job correctly. So we're controlling each other at the moment right now. How do you suggest the politicians act at the moment and not letting the financial markets determine too much of the solution that is coming up?
Okay, as far as these rating agencies are concerned, I think it's understandable that politicians are irritated by, you know, being put on a credit watch. At the same time, I think it's, truth be told, I think they should be on a credit watch. You know, the world we live in 2011 is not the world we lived in 2006. Talked earlier about this reflexivity in financial markets, you know, that if things look good, you know, then at least for a while they actually turn out well, and if they don't look so well, they actually don't turn out so well. You know, and they were very positive as exactly part of that mechanism in the upswing, and they're relatively more negative now on the down. That's part of the deal. And that doesn't have so much to do with them as institutions as it has to do with just the way that any financial market participant would evaluate. You know, if you would take those away and every pension fund or whoever else could just come to their own assessment of what's going on, I think they would be even more pessimistic about the prospects of, say, Dutch or German government debt than Standard and Poor's and Moody's are. Right? So I think, you know, this is really shooting the messenger. What can you do about, or to what degree should you accommodate that breathing down your neck of these financial markets? Well, as I said, I think there was an excessive fixation on that a little bit, because what has happened now, you know, it has spun a little bit out of control. You know, the actual interest that governments pay on their debt is something that was agreed to a long time ago, so that in secondary markets where debt is actually traded, these yields rise a little bit. Doesn't mean that the debt burden rises on the spot. It's only when new debt needs to be issued that that becomes the benchmark for the next batch of debt that you sell. Right? So it, you know, it's not as though Italy doesn't pay more interest now. It will have to. It will have to refinance its debt now. That's when. Right? So I think, you know, it's actually a little, you know, a little less bad, you know, than many people think it is. And then arguably the media has reported the whole thing. Question still remains: to what degree can the European Central Bank be part of that solution? It has the silver bullet. You may think that it's not a very good one, but it has the silver bullet that it could, you know, by itself start financing an important part of the government debt, as has happened partially in the United States, for example, where the Federal Reserve System has started buying big time into U.S. government debt. And, you know, of course, the dirty secret is that since Mr. Draghi has taken over at the helm of the European Central Bank, the amount of government paper that the European Central Bank has already risen substantially. You know, this has been a few weeks, three or four. So, you know, actually, quietly, they are already doing some of that. Doesn't change the fact that, of course, you know, the disquiet that there is there, I think, is tangible and is real. Most important thing for me is that you don't confuse finding some kind of short-term measure to stop, you know, the fire from burning with getting sustainable solution for the long term. You can somehow do those things at the same time, because I think at the end of the day, also what these people in the financial markets want to see is something that actually looks like a sustainable, valid model for where Europe wants to go from here. So austerity only and nothing else, no, that doesn't fly well in financial markets, because actually it's not a good idea. That is going to be bad for you. And so financial markets are actually right if they think, well, that's just going to, you know, keep us in a downward spiral. So I think, you know, if you have the right proper kind of solution, then I do have hope, faith, that in combination, you know, with just, you know, telling them to shut up a little bit, that's excellent.
Okay, there's time, space for one final short question, which raises the burden for anyone to ask one. But is there someone who would like to bring up another point? Well, you are not a student anymore. You are. Oh, well. Two questions.
This is not natural grey hair, yeah. you mentioned money that's not being used, and it'd be nice to get that into the system and to be productive. There seems to be a lot of money in China. Is there potential there?
There were moments in this crisis, I think two or three, when that was seriously considered. You know, at some point, you know, Italian government debt, you know, there was a sense that Berlusconi was sort of like, you know, trying to peddle some of his debt with the Chinese, and there was another moment when, you know, there was involvement in Greek government debt where China could be a role. I think if you, I talked earlier about imbalances that would somehow need to be, you know, put in balance back again, so within societies, between European societies. And then, of course, there's, you know, the bigger picture yet, you know, the global imbalances, where the first axis would be one between the United States and China, you know, something that needs to be put right. So if you ask me, you know, there is something fishy and definitely unsustainable about the buildup of credits, as it were, on the Chinese end of the ledger here. But that is mostly something where I think if we want the global economy to be on a sustainable footing for the next, say, what, 20, 30 years, you know, thinking farther ahead is foolish anyway. But then, you know, that is where I think, you know, sort of like, you know, that rebalancing would need to take shape. I think because the European Union as a whole is kind of like, okay, most of the, the import and export imbalances are within the European Union as a trading bloc. It's actually kind of okay on a global scale, that I don't think that, you know, getting money from China would be a solution without something going the other way. And I wouldn't know what that'd be. I think that rebalancing is something that needs to happen within Europe, and that Chinese money, they would want something back. And I'm not sure what that could be.
Because there was talk of them buying some infrastructure, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think that there is room for some investment, but I'm not sure whether that is something like the answer to that problem. I think it's fair enough, you know, for them to acquire ports in Greece, these kinds of things. I don't think that Europeans should rely on that, on an answer. Should be invited to come in, all good. But.
Okay, I'm not going to ask whether you are a student, but ask your question.
I am a student. Thank you for being here and for answering all our questions. I want to go back to your speech, and you were indicating one of the things that we didn't touch upon yet, and that was the rising inequality between the rich and the poor. It has always been a problem in the United States. Recently, it has been increasing in India as well. And you mentioned that in the OECD countries, it's going up as well. So, and separately, you also mentioned about a new philosophy. So other than this problem of mobility of credit and our inability to control where investment in the neoliberal market would lead to, what kind of this new philosophy might look like? You know, I think that would be a good last question. of not just a redistribution of wealth, but, you know, the margin of how much we get paid compared to a top few people. Thank you.
Yes. Of course, you know, it's nice to get the suggestion that, you know, I haven't been idealistic enough already, so, you know, we need to raise the bar still higher. See, the thing, you know, I have my personal views on, you know, what I think, you know, the good life is about, and how I think, you know, people in society should live together, and what would be sensible yardsticks for a fair distribution of wealth. Truth is, though, that I think, you know, that that's a, you know, whole different debate altogether. Because, you know, what I try to emphasize so far, that, you know, even though, you know, I'd be privately happy if we were to get to, you know, what I think would be, you know, more fair distribution of wealth in society, I think the main political argument right now, when we talk about the euro crisis, is not so much one about fairness, which I think will always be contested, but it's simply one about, you know, what makes economic sense right now. Right? So yes, I would totally applaud, you know, if we, in many ways, you know, I'd step away from, you know, what seems times like a societal obsession with material wealth. But even if we don't think that, even people, you know, who are completely happy in sort of like consumer society, even for them, I think, you know, if they want to keep up that kind of a lifestyle, then I think they'd be well advised to accord to economic order in which you see some kind of distribution of wealth. So, you know, what I get from your sentiment, I would probably agree to that. I think the good news is, for my proposals to be at least sensible, we don't even need people who share that sentiment. All they need is some economic sense.
Okay. Well, as you say, a good final question. So let's conclude. And I have a question to you, actually, because what strikes me in this whole, not only this debate, but also in the news, and I am a bit sad about that, actually, Sherp, is that we don't hear much from the European Parliament in this whole euro crisis. So actually my suggestion, Daniel, is, you know, lifting the scales, why wouldn't you be on the list for some party for the next European parliamentary elections so that you can also practice the ideals in the European arena? And then talking about Demos, you can, of course, sit and wait for Demos to emerge. But why not give the good example? And if there is one arena in the European Union where that example has to be given, then is the European Parliament. We can be more or less skeptical, but this is a place where I think we face a challenge. Think about that suggestion that I have tomorrow morning when you pick your bicycle. Maybe you take a different route. I would like you to thank you very much on behalf of the House of Europa and the Montesquieu Institute. Not giving you a bottle of wine, which we normally do, but you already got one 2 weeks ago in another lecture, remember? So I have something that is not the European Parliament, but it is a book about the Dutch Eurocommissioners, of course published under auspices of the Montesquieu Institute. Thanks very much again, Daniel, for the inspiring discussion that you were willing to have with us. Thanks very much. That deserves an applause.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I would like to, because you can, of course, I know that you will never have enough about these kinds of discussions and presentations. So if you don't have enough yet of it, take a look at our website, Montesquieu Institute, where you find an announcement. I don't want to speak in competition with the European Union Studies Program, but we have a masterclass that begins end January and is about the European crisis, about the different faces of the European crisis, a political face, a cultural face, an economic face. And we will have a mixture of keynote speakers, partly from academics, but also partly from the professional, as we say, the real world of policymaking and politics.